This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Dramatic readings from the book, Voices of a People's History of the United States, with Howard Zinn, Anthony Arnov, H. Scott Momaday, and others. Recorded in Santa Fe on April 26, 2006. Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnov have selected for this book many voices of resistance in poems, speeches, letters, and memoirs, including such disparate Americans as Bob Dylan, Fannie Lou Hamer, Cesar Chavez, Rachel Corrie, Helen Keller, and scores of others.
I was just thinking as I walked out here that I'd pretend I was the decider tonight, and I decided to come out and introduce Howard Zinn. I'm Patrick Lannan, and obviously it's my pleasure to welcome all of you who I could see a minute ago. I can't see now, but I know you're here. And I realize that not everybody in town could get in, but hopefully there's ways around that. I think all of us have been looking forward to this particular evening for months, a live performance reading of selections from Howard Zinn and Anthony Arnov's Voices of a People's History of the United States. And I'm not trying to stand in your way between, I'm not trying to be between you and the event, but I'd like to mention a couple things that I think are important. One is that Lannan has added a reading and conversation event to this season's schedule. I'm not sure how many people are aware of it. On June 28th, Andrew Basevic, a graduate of West Point, a Vietnam veteran, has a PhD in history from Princeton. He's currently professor of international relations and director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. He wrote a book that came out in 2005 that we noted in our awards and fellowships announcement as a very special, very notable book for 2005. It's called The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Being Seduced by War. And Andrew's going to come out here, and he's going to give a talk, and it's going to be followed by a discussion or conversation with Lewis Lapham, former editor of Harper's Magazine. So I'd encourage you to keep your eye on that event. Also, because obviously everybody in town couldn't get in here tonight, tonight's just a reminder that tonight's program will be broadcast on KUNM on Saturday at 6 p.m. That's 89.9 on your dial. And on our local station, KSFR 90.7, on Sunday at 2 p.m. Also, many of you may not know this yet, but we're now podcasting our readings and conversations. We're really turning into a high-tech outfit. If you visit our website, it's www.lannan.org. You can learn more about the whole program. You can also subscribe if you want, and if you subscribe, the events are automatically downloaded to your computer. And then last but not least, and I think this is maybe as much a highlight as tonight, tomorrow from 9:30 to 11 a.m. here at the Lensic on this stage, there'll be another presentation of the voices. And this program will feature readings selected by the students from Capital High School and Monte Del Sol Charter School. This event will be free and is open to the public, so I might tell people about it. I think it'll be perhaps be a very moving event. Howard Zinn, I've been thinking about him a lot recently, and what can I say that hasn't been said? I mean, he wrote arguably the most important survey book of American history ever written, A People's History of the United States. It came out, I believe, in 1980. And since then, I think to about now is sold almost 1,100,000 copies, which is pretty amazing. And interestingly enough, maybe it's an indication of the kind of troubled times we're in, sales on an annual basis have seemed to be curving up. Howard himself told me they're averaging now about 100,000 a year. So I think there's obviously it fills a need, a deep-seated need to understand the real history of this country and the people who made it. This has now been supplemented by the aforementioned book, The Voices of a People's History of the United States, which is being performed tonight. Also, just recently, a teacher's guide to the Voices book came out. So there's like a package, a trilogy, having to do with the history of the United States. And this teaching guide was written by a woman named Gail Olson Raymer, who's a professor at Humboldt University. And she got contributions from 8 different high school teachers. I think the key to all of these kinds of texts is if you can do some of the teachers' work and provide a guide, they're more likely to be used. And I have to say that if these books were used and widely used, ideally used in all the schools in America, every student took a year to study American history using Howard Zinn's book, I have to believe that this would be a better country. So short of the... short of that, as many schools as possible is something we should really hope for. And I think this package, I'm not sure if the guide's out at the counter out there, but it is available. It's also published by Seven Stories Press. Today, I think all of us who are probably here tonight are aware of the fact that we seem to live in a country with no memory. History seems to move by us as CNN reports it, or Fox News, or CBS, or NBC. And that's a very dangerous situation for a democracy. I recently came across a quote from Cicero, who I remember painfully from high school Latin, but for the students, he was a Roman statesman and orator and philosopher. That's very short, but he says, and I think I'm going to read it twice, "Not to know what happened before one was born is always to be a child." Not to know what happened before one was born is always to be a child. And it seems so prescient, you know. Howard Zinn has devoted his public and professional life to his work, his teaching, his writing, his public speaking, and his social activism. I don't really know, and I'd be embarrassed to ask him, but how many times he's been arrested. But he really, he stands right up in front for his convictions. And I think without question, he's as good an example as you can possibly find of the informed citizen who's deeply committed to social justice. And thinking of what I just read from Cicero, I think it's fair to say he's worked as hard as anybody ever to change American children into American adults. Please join me in welcoming Howard Zinn.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I actually can't see you, but I sort of feel that you're out there. I do want to thank Patrick Lannan, not just for what he said up here, which I didn't hear, but for really, really being responsible for all of this happening. He and this wonderful staff of people who work with the Lannan Foundation, John Evans and Christy Masuera Davis and Kristen Ryan. Also want to thank the staff of the Lensic Performing Arts Center. Well, you can see what they've done here. And I must thank Anthony Arnov, my friend, co-editor, co-writer, who, along with Brenda Coughlin, worked so hard to bring this whole evening together. And now, I will say a little bit. At least I claim it will be a little bit, before introducing the readers for the evening. I want to tell you a little about how this project came about. By this project, I mean the Voices of a People's History, from which the readings will be done tonight. My People's History of the United States, when some of us examined it, some of us meaning Anthony Arnov, Daniel Simon of Seven Stories Press, who took a look at it and guessed at what people were really liking in it and what we liked in it. And one of the things we liked most in the People's History was not necessarily my words, although I didn't like to think that. But all these little nuggets of quotations, these little statements, the words of other people, the words of the people in history, not the words of a historian or this historian or that historian, but the words of the people who made history. And so we decided, no, let's expand on that. Let's have a book just of the words of the people. And let's have the words of, no, not the words of the presidents. I'm sure the founding fathers were eloquent and smart and so on, and we obviously have come a long way from that, you see. But not even the words of the founding fathers, not the words of the important people. When I was going to graduate school, there was a book of documents which was standard, and it was very good and very useful. It was called Documents of American History. It was edited by a famous and fine historian named Henry Steele Commager, whose name some of you may recognize. And it was a very valuable collection of presidential speeches, congressional enactments, judicial decisions, very useful. But all the words of the people at the top of the ladder, all the words of the elite of the American society. And, of course, when I wrote The People's History, I wanted to not to replicate that. And when we put together Voices of a People's History in the United States, we didn't want those voices, which have been heard enough. Presidents have been heard so much, too much. And we wanted the voices of the people who have not been heard so much. And we wanted the voices of Las Casas, who blew the whistle on Columbus way back then, and who exposed Columbus's crimes. We wanted the voices of mill girls in Lowell, and the voices of angry women workers and fugitive slaves and anti-war protesters and strikers of all kinds and anarchists and socialists and dissidents. Those are the words we wanted, because we thought those represented the best in America. And so we collected about 200 documents, of which tonight you will hear, you know, perhaps 14 or 15 or so. And this is a different kind of history. This is a history which doesn't celebrate the usual heroes. And we don't celebrate Andrew Jackson, that racist, that slave owner, that killer of Indians. But it's interesting, when you study history in, you know, traditional textbooks and lectures, they use the phrase Jacksonian democracy. There's very little democracy under Jackson. He's the man who signed the order to expel 16,000 Indians, Cherokees and Choctaws and other members of the five civilized tribes from the lands that they lived on in the southeast, and marched them with the army behind them across the Mississippi, the Trail of Tears, in which 4,000 people died. No, we weren't going to celebrate Andrew Jackson. We wanted to celebrate the Cherokees. We didn't want to celebrate Lincoln, even, who is celebrated all the time. And sure, and he had a certain compassion, but the ending of slavery was not his first priority. And we wanted the voices of people for whose the ending of slavery was the first priority. And so we have the voices of Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth, and you will hear their voices tonight. Our heroes are very different. Our heroes are not Theodore Roosevelt. If you look at the lists that they always put together of, oh, who are the greatest presidents, you will always find Theodore Roosevelt up there on the list. That always annoyed me, because that was one among many things that annoyed me. Yes, the Theodore Roosevelt was a special annoyance, because Roosevelt, the lover of war, Roosevelt, the man who congratulated an American general for committing a massacre of Filipinos in 1906 on a southern island in the Philippines. No, he was not going to be the hero of our work. Our hero was going to be Mark Twain. And a lot of people, everybody knows Mark Twain as a novelist. People did not know and still do not know that Mark Twain was an anti-imperialist and that Mark Twain denounced Theodore Roosevelt for his actions in the Philippines. We weren't going to celebrate Woodrow Wilson, although the history books proclaim Woodrow Wilson to be an idealist and a believer at some point in his life, apparently, in self-determination, except that he didn't believe in self-determination for the Mexicans when he bombarded their coast, didn't believe in self-determination for Haiti when he sent an occupying army into Haiti or one into the Dominican Republic. No, we want to celebrate Helen Keller. Here's another person who we all learn about in school, Helen Keller, you know, what she overcame and became famous. But people do not learn in school that Helen Keller was a speaker against World War I. That she was a Union person. She even refused to cross a picket line that was picketing a theater where a play about her was going on. These are the kind of people. Even those people who, you know, very often people still think of as heroes, John F. Kennedy, but no. He was part of the escalation of the war in Vietnam, and he was very cool to the idea of doing anything about racial segregation until black people marched by the tens of thousands in the streets of Birmingham and other places and created a national commotion, which then pushed Kennedy and Johnson and Congress into finally doing something about racial segregation in the South. So I think you get the idea. Those are the people we care about. Those are the voices you will hear. You'll hear some of them tonight. And we have quite a remarkable group of readers who have volunteered to come here tonight to read to you. And first, Anthony Arnov, who will help me in introducing the readers. Jane Fonda. Marissa Tomei. Lucille Clifton. Ruben Martinez. Kerry Washington. And Scott Momaday. There's the usual story of Columbus as a hero, still celebrated all over the country and in classrooms and so on, but that story is beginning to change, and one of the reasons it's beginning to change is we have the testimony of Bartolomé de las Casas, who was there at the time and who wrote volumes about what he saw Columbus and the other Spaniards did. And so in the following passages, Las Casas describes what he witnessed.
The Indies were discovered in the year 1492. 49 years have passed since the first settlers penetrated the land, the first being the large and most happy isle called Española, perhaps the most densely populated place in the world. There must be close to 200 leagues of land on this island, and all the land so far discovered is a beehive of people. It is as though God had crowded into these lands the great majority of mankind. And of all the infinite universe of humanity, these people are the most guileless, the most devoid of wickedness and duplicity, the most obedient and faithful to their native masters and to the Spanish Christians whom they serve. And because they're so weak and complacent, they're less able to do heavy labor and soon die of no matter what malady. Yet into this sheepfold, into this land of meek outcasts, there came some Spaniards who immediately behaved like ravening wild beasts, wolves, tigers, or lions that had been starved for many days, killing, terrorizing, afflicting, torturing, and destroying the native peoples, doing all this with the strangest and most varied new methods of cruelty never seen or heard before, and to such a degree that this island of Hispaniola, once so populous, having a population that I estimated to be more than 3 millions, has now a population of barely 200 persons. Their reason for killing and destroying such an infinite number of souls is that the Christians have an ultimate aim, which is to acquire gold and to swell themselves with riches in a very brief time and thus rise to a high estate disproportionate to their merits. It should be kept in mind that their insatiable greed and ambition, the greatest ever seen in the world, is the cause of their villainies. And also, those lands are so rich and felicitous, the native people so meek and patient, so easy to subject, that our Spaniards have no more consideration for them than beasts. No. No. For thanks be to God, they have treated beasts with some respect. I should say instead like excrement on the public squares. The Indians began to seek ways to throw the Christians out of their lands. They took up arms, but their weapons were very weak and of little service in offense and still less in defense. The Christians, with their horses and swords and pikes, began to carry out massacres and strange cruelties against them. They attacked the towns and spared neither the children, nor the aged, nor pregnant women, nor women in childbed, not only stabbing them and dismembering them, but cutting them to pieces as if dealing with sheep in a slaughterhouse. They made some low, wide gallows on which the victims' feet almost touched the ground, stringing up their victims in lots of 13 in memory of our Redeemer and his 12 apostles, then set burning wood to their feet and thus burned them alive. When tied to the stake, the cacique Atue, a very important noble, was told by a Franciscan friar about the God of the Christians and of the articles of the faith, and he was told what he could do in the brief time that remained to him in order to be saved and go to heaven. The cacique, who had never heard any of this before, and was told that he would go to Inferno, where, if he did not adopt the Christian faith, he would suffer eternal torment, asked the Franciscan friar if Christians all went to heaven. When told that they did, he said he'd prefer to go to hell.
Maria Stuart was a leader in the struggle to end slavery. Her writings, speeches, and activism were directed primarily at black rather than white abolitionists. In 1831, she wrote the first public manifesto of an African-American woman in U.S. history. And in 1833, she delivered this speech at the African Masonic Hall.
Most of our color have been taught to stand in fear of the white man, from their earliest infancy to work as soon as they could walk and call master before they could scarce lisp the name mother. Continual fear and laborious servitude have in some degree lessened in us that natural force and energy which belong to man, or else in defiance of opposition, our men before this would have nobly and boldly contended for their rights. Give the man of color an equal opportunity with the white, from the cradle to manhood and from manhood to the grave, and you would discover the dignified statesman, the man of science and the philosopher. But there is no such opportunity for the sons of Africa. And I fear that our powerful ones are fully determined that there never shall be. Oh, ye sons of Africa, when will your voices be heard in our legislative halls in defiance of your enemies, contending for equal rights and liberty? Is it possible that for the want of knowledge we have labored for hundreds of years to support others and been content to receive what they chose to give us in return? Cast your eyes about. Look as far as you can see. All is owned by the lordly white, except for here and there a lowly dwelling which the man of color, midst deprivations, fraud, and opposition, has been scarce able to procure. Like King Solomon, who put neither nail nor hammer to the temple, yet received the praise, so also have the white Americans gained themselves a name, like the names of the great men that are in the earth, while in reality we have been their principal foundation and support. We have pursued the shadow. They have obtained the substance. We have performed the labor. They have received the profits. We have planted the vines. They have eaten the fruits of them.
Early capitalism showed itself in the building of textile mills in Lowell, Massachusetts in the early 19th century. And they recruited young women from rural New England as their labor force. They assumed that these women would be docile and easily managed. Instead, the young women in the Lowell mills formed reading circles, organized to demand their rights. And here, Harriet Hanson Robinson, who started work in the mills when she was only 10, recounts in later years a strike of the Lowell women.
At the time the Lowell cotton mills were started, the factory girl was the lowest among women. In England, and in France particularly, great injustice had been done to her real character. She was represented as subjected to influences that could not fail to destroy her purity and self-respect. In the eyes of her overseer, she was but a brute, slave, to be beaten, pinched, and pushed about. One of the first strikes of the cotton factory operatives that ever took place in this country was that in Lowell in October in 1836, when it was announced that wages were to be cut down. Great indignation was felt, and it was decided to strike en masse. This was done. The mills were shut down, and the girls went in procession from their several corporations to the Grove on Chapel Hill and listened to incendiary speeches from early labor reformers. One of the girls stood on a pump and gave vent to the feelings of her companions in a neat speech, declaring that it was their duty to resist all attempts at cutting down the wages. This was the first time a woman had spoken in public in Lowell, and the event caused surprise and consternation among her audience. Cutting down the wages was not their only grievance, nor the only cause of this strike. Hitherto, the corporations had paid 25 cents a week toward the board of each operative, and now it was their purpose to have the girls pay this sum. And this, in addition to cutting wages, would make a difference of at least $1 a week. It was estimated that as many as 1,200 or 1,500 girls turned out and walked in procession through the streets. My own recollection of this first strike, or turnout as it was called, is very vivid. I worked in a lower room where I had heard the proposed strike fully, if not vehemently, discussed. I had been an ardent listener to what was said against this attempt at oppression on the part of the corporation. And naturally, I took sides with the strikers. When the day came on which the girls were to turn out, those in the upper rooms started first, and so many of them left that our mill was shut down at once. Then, when the girls in my room stood irresolute, uncertain what to do, asking each other, "Would you? Or shall we turn out?" And not one of them having the courage to lead off, I, who began to think that they would not go out after all their talk, became impatient and started on ahead, saying with childish bravado, "I don't care what you do, I am going to turn out, whether anyone else does or not." And I marched out and was followed by the others. As I looked back at the long line that followed me, I was more proud than I have ever been at any success I may have achieved.
In this editorial from 1848, the North Star, the abolitionist newspaper edited in Rochester, New York by Frederick Douglass, argued the case against the war on Mexico.
From aught that appears in the present position and movements of the executive and cabinet, the proceedings of either branch of the National Congress, the several state legislatures, North and South, the spirit of the public press, slight hope can rationally be predicated of a very speedy termination of the present disgraceful, cruel, and iniquitous war with our sister republic. Mexico seems a doomed victim to Anglo-Saxon cupidity and love of dominion. The determination of our slave-holding president to prosecute the war, and the probability of his success in wringing from the people men and money to carry it on, is made evident, rather than doubtful, by the puny opposition against him. No politician of any considerable distinction or eminence seems willing to hazard his popularity with his party or stem the fierce current of executive influence by an open and unqualified disapprobation of the war. None seem willing to take their stand for peace at all risks, and all seem willing that the war should be carried on in some form or other. We have no preference for parties regarding this slave-holding crusade. The one is as bad as the other. The friends of peace have nothing to hope from either. The Democrats claim the credit of commencing, and the Whigs monopolize the glory of voting supplies and carrying on the war, branding the war as dishonorably commenced, yet boldly persisting in pressing it on. Mm-hmm. Grasping ambition, tyrannical usurpation, atrocious aggression, cruel and haughty pride spread and pervade the land. The curse is upon us. The plague is abroad. A general outcry is heard. Vigorous prosecution of the war. Mexico must be humbled. Conquer the peace. War forced upon us. National honor. The whole of Mexico. Our destiny. The whole continent. Anglo-Saxon blood. More territory. Free institutions. Our country. The taste of human blood and the smell of powder seemed to have extinguished the senses, seared the conscience, and subverted the reason of the people to a degree that may well induce the gloomy apprehension that our nation has fully entered on her downward career and yielded herself up to the revolting idea of battle and blood. Unavailing as our voice may be, We wish to warn our fellow countrymen that they may follow the course which they have marked out for themselves. No barrier may be sufficient to obstruct them. They may accomplish all they desire. Mexico may fall before them. She may be conquered and subdued. Her government may indeed be annihilated. But so sure as there is a God of justice, we shall not go unpunished. The penalty is certain. We cannot escape. A terrible retribution awaits us. And so, we beseech our countrymen to leave off this horrid conflict, abandon their murderous plans, and forsake the way of blood. Our country may yet be saved. Let the press, the pulpit, the church, the people at large unite at once, and let petitions flood the halls of Congress by the millions, asking for the instant recall of our forces from Iraq, I mean Mexico.
In the year 1851, the black abolitionists and former slaves Sojourner Truth spoke to a gathering of feminists in Akron, Ohio. This spontaneous speech, only a few minutes long, helped redefine feminism and abolitionism.
Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North all talking about rights, the white men are going to be in a pretty fix soon. But what's all this talking here about? That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into a carriage or over mud puddles or it gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barn, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as any man when I could get it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children. And seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's this they call it? Intellect? Yeah, that's it, honey. Well, what's that got to do with women's rights or Negroes' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says women can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Well, where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. Now, they is asking to do it. The men better let them.
July 4th is held up as a day to celebrate the struggle for freedom and independence. But the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, himself a former slave, dared to challenge the veneration of the holiday in a speech to the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in 1852.
Mr. President, friends and fellow citizens, he who could address this audience without a quailing sensation has stronger nerves than I have. I do not remember ever to have appeared as a speaker before any assembly more shrinkingly, nor with greater distrust of my ability than I do this day. A feeling has crept over me quite unfavorable to the exercise of my limited powers of speech. Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, Why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and national justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I, therefore, called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought whippings and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need a storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
In November of 1872, Susan B. Anthony was one of 14 women who defied the law to cast a ballot in the presidential election. She was arrested for knowingly voting without having a lawful right to vote. And on June 18, 1873, she was found guilty. The next day, when her lawyer appealed the verdict, she addressed the court in response to a question from the judge, Ward Hunt.
Has the prisoner anything to say why sentence shall not be pronounced?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, I have many things to say. For in your ordered verdict of guilty, you have trampled underfoot every vital principle of our government. My natural rights, my civil rights, my political rights, my judicial rights are all ignored. Robbed of the fundamental privilege of citizenship, I am degraded from the status of a citizen to that of a subject. And not only myself individually, but all of my sex are, by your honor's verdict, doomed to political subjugation under this so-called Republican form of government.
The court cannot listen to a rehearsal of argument which the prisoner's counsel has already consumed 3 hours in presenting.
May it please your honor, I'm not arguing the question, but simply stating the reasons why sentence cannot, in justice, be pronounced against me. Your denial of my citizen's right to vote is the denial of my right of consent as one of the governed, the denial of my right of representation as one of the taxed, the denial of my right to a trial by a jury of my peers. Therefore, the denial of my sacred right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and property.
The court must insist, the prisoner has been tried according to the established forms of law.
Oh, yes, yes, your honor. But by forms of law all made by men, interpreted by men, administered by men, in favor of men against women. And hence, your honor's ordered verdict of guilty against a United States citizen for the exercise of the citizen's right to vote, simply because that citizen was a woman and not a man. But only yesterday, the same man-made forms of law declared it a crime punishable with a $1,000 fine and 6 months imprisonment to give a cup of cold water, a crust of bread, or a night shelter to a panting fugitive tracking his way to Canada. And every man or woman in whose veins coursed a drop of human sympathy violated that wicked law, reckless of consequences, and was justified in doing so. As then, the slaves who got their freedom had to take it over or under or through the unjust forms of law. Precisely so now must women take it to get the right to vote and a voice in this government. And I have taken mine, and I mean to take it at every opportunity.
The court must insist. The sentence of the court is that you pay a fine of $100 and the costs of prosecution.
May it please your honor, I will never pay a dollar of your unjust penalty. All the stock and trade I possess is a debt of $10,000 incurred by publishing my paper, The Revolution, the sole object of which was to educate all women to do precisely as I have done, rebel against your man-made, unjust, unconstitutional forms of law, which tax, fine, imprison, and hang women while denying them the right of representation in the government. And I will work on with might and main to pay every dollar of that honest debt. But not a penny shall go to this unjust claim. And I shall earnestly and persistently continue to urge all women to the practical recognition of the old revolutionary maxim, resistance to tyranny is obedience to God.
One of the worst massacres of Native Americans occurred on December 29, 1890, and was, as with so many other massacres, reported with indifference and even praised. The massacre followed soon after the killing of the Indian leader, Sitting Bull. After his death, the Saturday Pioneer in Aberdeen, South Dakota, proclaimed, "The whites, by law of conquest, by justice of civilization, are masters of the American continent, and the best safety of the frontier settlers will be secured by the total annihilation of the few remaining Indians." The editor of the paper was L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz. Here are two narratives of the massacre. The first, a poem from In the Presence of the Sun by N. Scott Momaday, and the second by the Oglala Sioux leader, Black Elk, from his oral testimony, Black Elk Speaks.
December 29th, 1890, Wounded Knee Creek. In the shine of photographs are the slain, frozen and black, on a simple field of snow. They image ceremony. Women and children dancing, old men prancing, making fun. In autumn, there were songs, long since muted in the blizzard. In summer, the wild buckwheat shone like fox fur and quill work, and dusk guttered on the creek. Now, in serene attitudes of dance, the dead, in glossy death, are drawn in ancient light. Black Elk. After the soldiers marched away, Red Crow and I started back toward Pine Ridge together, and I took the little baby that I told you about. Red Crow had one, too. We were going back to Pine Ridge because we thought there was peace back home, but it was not so. While we were gone, there was a fight around the agency, and our people had all gone away. They had gone away so fast that they left all the teepees standing. It was nearly dark when we passed north of Pine Ridge, where the hospital is now, and some soldiers shot at us, but did not hit us. We rode into the camp, and it was all empty. We were very hungry, because we had not eaten anything since early morning, so we peeped into the teepees until we saw where there was a pot with papa, dried meat, cooked in it. We sat down in there and began to eat. While we were doing this, the soldiers shot at the teepee, and a bullet struck right between Red Crow and me. It threw dust in the soup, but we kept right on eating until we had had our fill. Then we took the babies and got on our horses and rode away. If that bullet had only killed me, then I could have died with Papa in my mouth. The people had fled down Clay Creek, and we followed their trail. It was dark now, and late in the night we came to where they were camped without teepees. They were just sitting by little fires, and the snow was beginning to blow. We rode in among them, and I heard my mother's voice. She was singing a death song for me, because she felt sure that I had died over there. She was so glad to see me that she cried and cried. Women who had milk fed the little babies that Red Crow and I brought with us. I think nobody but the little children slept any that night. The snow blew and we had no teepees. When it was getting light, a war party went out and I went along, but this time I took a gun with me. When I started out the day before at Wounded Knee, I took only my sacred bow, which was not made to shoot with, because I was a little in doubt about the Wanikia religion at that time, and I did not really want to kill anybody because of it. I did not feel that way anymore. After what I had seen over there, I wanted revenge. I wanted to kill. I remembered my great vision, the part where the geese of the north appeared. I depended upon their power. Stretching out my arms with my gun in the right hand, like a goose soaring when it flies low to turn in a change of weather. I made the sound the geese make, brrp, 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 and doing this, I charged. The soldiers saw and began shooting fast at me. I kept right on with my buckskin running, shot in their faces when I was near, then swung wide and rode back up the hill. All this time, the bullets were buzzing around me, and I was not touched. I was not even afraid. It was like being in a dream about shooting. But just then, as I had reached the very top of the hill, suddenly it was like waking up, and I was afraid. I dropped my arms and quit making the goose cry. Just as I did this, I felt something strike my belt as though someone had hit me there with the back of an axe. I nearly fell out of my saddle, but I managed to hold on and rode over the hill. By now it looked as though the soldiers would be wiped out and the Lakotas were fighting harder, but I heard that after I left, the Black Wasichu soldiers came and the Lakotas had to retreat. There were many of our children in the mission, and the sisters and priests were taking care of them. I heard there were sisters and priests right in the battle, helping wounded people and praying. There was a man by the name of Little Soldier who took charge of me and brought me to where our people were camped. While we were there, over at the mission, over at the mission fight. They had fled to the Onatgaji and were camped on top of it, where the women and children would be safe from soldiers. Old Hollowhorn was there. He was a very powerful bear medicine man, and he came over to heal my wound. In 3 days, I could walk, but I kept a piece of the blanket tied around my belly. It was now nearly the middle of the moon of frost in the teepee, January. We heard that soldiers were on Smoky Earth River and were coming to attack the Onatgaji. They were near Blackfeather's place, so a party of about 60 of us started on the warpath to find them. My mother tried to keep me at home because, although I could walk and ride a horse, my wound was not all healed yet. But I would not stay, for after what I had seen at Wounded Knee, I wanted a chance to kill soldiers. We wanted a much bigger war party so that we could meet the soldiers and get revenge. But this was hard because our people were not all of the same mind and they were hungry and cold. We had a meeting there and were all ready to go out with more warriors when Afraid of His Horses came over from Pine Ridge to make peace with Red Cloud, who was with us there. Our party wanted to go out and fight anyway, but Red Cloud made a speech to us something like this. Brothers, this is a very hard winter. The women and children are starving and freezing. If this were summer, I would say to keep on fighting to the end. But we cannot do this. We must think of the women and children, and that is very hard for them. So we must make peace, and I will see that nobody is hurt by the soldiers. The people agreed to this, for it was true. So we broke camp next day and went down from the Onatgaji to Pine Ridge, and many, many Lakotas were already there. Also there were many, many soldiers. They stood in two lines with their guns held in front of them as we went through to where we camped. And so it was all over. I did not know then how much was ended. When I look back now from this high hill of my old age, I can still see the butchered women and children lying heaped and scattered all along the crooked gulch, as plain as I saw them with eyes still young. And I can see that something else died there in the bloody mud and was buried in the blizzard. A people's dream died there. It was a beautiful dream. And I, to whom so great a vision was given in my youth, you see me now, a pitiful old man who has done nothing. For the nation's hoop is broken and scattered. There is no center any longer. And the sacred tree is dead.
Emma Goldman became famous as an anarchist and feminist orator, writer, imprisoned many times for her ideas. After the outbreak of World War I in Europe and before the entrance of the United States into the war, she gave this speech in San Francisco.
What is patriotism? Is it love of one's birthplace, the place of childhood's recollections and hopes, dreams and aspirations? Patriotism, sir, is the last resort of scoundrels, said Dr. Johnson. Leo Tolstoy, the greatest anti-patriot of our times, defines patriotism as the principle that will justify the training of wholesale murderers. A trade that requires better equipment for the exercise of man-killing than the making of such necessities of life as shoes, clothing, and houses. A trade that guarantees better returns and greater glory than that of the average working man. Indeed, conceit, arrogance, and egotism are the essentials of patriotism. Let me illustrate. Patriotism assumes that our globe is divided into little spots, each one surrounded by an iron gate. Those who have had the fortune of being born on some particular spot consider themselves better, nobler, grander, more intelligent than the living beings inhabiting any other spot. It is therefore the duty of everyone living on that chosen spot to fight, kill, and die in the attempt to impose his superiority upon all others. The inhabitants of the other spots reason in like manner, of course, with the result that from early infancy, the mind of the child is poisoned with blood-curdling stories about the Germans, the French, the Italians, Russians, etc. When the child has reached manhood, he is thoroughly saturated with the belief that he is chosen by the Lord himself to defend his country against the attack or invasion of any foreigner. It is for that purpose that we are clamoring for a greater army and navy, more battleships and ammunition. We Americans claim to be a peace-loving people. We hate bloodshed. We are opposed to violence. Yet we go into spasms of joy over the possibility of projecting dynamite bombs from flying machines upon helpless citizens. Our hearts swell with pride at the thought that America is becoming the most powerful nation on earth and that it will eventually plant her iron foot on the necks of all other nations. Such is the logic of patriotism. Thinking men and women the world over are beginning to realize that patriotism is too narrow and limited a conception to meet the necessities of our time. The centralization of power has brought into being an international feeling of solidarity among the oppressed nations of the world. A solidarity which represents a greater harmony of interests between the working man of America and his brothers abroad than between the American miner and his exploiting compatriot. A solidarity which fears not foreign invasion because it is bringing all the workers to the point when they will say to their masters, "Go and do your own killing. We have done it long enough for you."
The civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer was born in Montgomery County, Mississippi, the daughter of two sharecroppers. In 1962, she joined a group of 18 blacks who traveled to the courthouse in Indianola to register to vote. At the time, fewer than 7% of blacks were registered to vote in Mississippi. Here, Hamer, a leader of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, describes to the Credentials Committee of the Democratic National Convention in Washington in 1964 the treatment she and others received for trying to vote.
Mr. Chairman and the Credentials Committee, my name is Ms. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Ruleville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the country courthouse in Indianola to try to register, to try to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by Mississippi men, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Ruleville, we was held up by the city police and the state highway and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color. After we paid the fine among us, we continued on to Ruleville, and Reverend Jeff Sonny, carried me 4 miles in the rural area where I had worked as a timekeeper and sharecropper for 18 years. I was met there by my children, who told me the plantation owner was angry because I had gone down to try to register. After they told me, my husband came and said that the plantation owner was raising Cain because I had tried to register. And before he quit talking, the plantation owner came and said, "Fannie Lou, do you know, did Pap tell you what I said?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I mean that." He said, "If you don't go down and withdraw your resignation, your registration, you will have to leave because we are not ready for that in Mississippi." And I addressed him and I told him and said, "I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself." I had to leave that same night. On the 10th of September, 1962, 16 bullets was fired into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Tucker for me. That same night, 2 girls were shot in Ruleville, Mississippi. Also, Mr. Joe McDonald's house was shot in. And in June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop, was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by the Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, which is Montgomery County, 4 of the people got off to use the washroom and 2 of the people to use the restaurant. 2 of the people wanted to use the washroom. The 4 people that had gone in to use the restaurant was ordered out. During the time I was on the bus, but when I looked through the window and saw they had rushed out, I got off of the bus to see what had happened. And one of the ladies said, "It was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out." I got back on the bus, and one of the persons that used the washroom got back on the bus too. As soon as I was seated on the bus, I saw when they began to get the 4 people in a highway patrolman's car. I stepped off of the bus to see what was happening, and somebody screamed from the car that the 4 workers was in and said, "Get that one there." And when I went to get in the car, when the man told me I was under arrest, he kicked me. I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room. They left some of the people in the booking room and began to place us in cells. I was placed in a cell with a young woman called Ms. Yvesta Simpson. After I was placed in the cell, I began to hear the sounds of kicks and screams. I could hear somebody say, "Can't you say yes, sir, nigger? Can you say yes, sir?" And they would say other horrible names. She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir. So say it." She said, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her. I don't know how long, and after a while she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on these people. And it wasn't too long before 3 white men came to my cell. One of them was a state highway patrolman, and he asked me where I was from, and I told him Ruleville, and he said, "We're going to check this." And they left my cell. And it wasn't too long before they came back. He said, "You are from Ruleville, all right." And he used a curse word. And he said, "We're going to make you wish you was dead." I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had 2 Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman for me, to lay down on a bunk bed in my face, and I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat, and I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted, and I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet, and the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro who had beat me to sit on my feet to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high, he walked over and pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this on account we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America? The land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America.
In a protest at an army recruiting station in Massachusetts. And so he had a choice whether to go and debate Charles Frankel about civil disobedience and practice it, or whether to go to court. And he chose to go to the debate. And the next day when he came back to his class at Boston University, taught the class, he was met by two policemen and taken off to court. But the night before, he gave this speech.
I start from the supposition that the world is topsy-turvy, that things are all wrong, that the wrong people are in jail and the wrong people are out of jail, that the wrong people are in power and the wrong people are out of power, that the wealth is distributed in this country and in the world in such a way as not simply to require small reform, but to require a drastic reallocation of wealth. I start from the supposition that we don't have to say too much about this, because all we have to do is think about the state of the world today and realize that things are all upside down. Daniel Berrigan is in jail, a Catholic priest, a poet who opposes the war, and J. Edgar Hoover is free. David Dellinger, who has opposed war ever since he was this high and has used all of his energy and passion against it, is in danger of going to jail. The men who are responsible for the My Lai massacre are not on trial. They are in Washington, serving various functions, primary and subordinate, that have to do with the unleashing of massacres, which surprise them when they occur. If you don't think, if you just listen to TV and read scholarly things, you actually begin to think that things are not so bad, or that just little things are wrong. But you have to get a little detached and then come back and look at the world, and you are horrified. So we have to start from that supposition that things are really topsy-turvy. And our topic is topsy-turvy, civil disobedience. As soon as you say the topic is civil disobedience, you are saying our problem is civil disobedience. That is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is the numbers of people all over the world who have obeyed the dictates of the leaders of their government and have gone to war, and millions have been killed because of this obedience. We recognize this for Nazi Germany. We know that the problem there was obedience, that the people obeyed Hitler. People obeyed. That was wrong. They should have challenged. They should have resisted. And if we were only there, we would have showed them. Even in Stalin's Russia, we can understand that. People are obedient, all these herd-like people. Remember those bad old days when people were exploited by feudalism? Everything was terrible in the Middle Ages, but now we have Western civilization, the rule of law. The rule of law has regularized and maximized the injustice that existed before the rule of law. That is what the rule of law has done. When in all the nations of the world, the rule of law is the darling of the leaders and the plague of the people, we ought to begin to recognize this. We have to transcend these national boundaries in our thinking. Nixon and Brezhnev have much more in common with one another than we have with Nixon. J. Edgar Hoover has far more in common with the head of the Soviet secret police than he has with us. It's the international dedication to law and order that binds the leaders of all countries in a comradely bond. That's why we are always surprised when they get together. They smile. They shake hands. They smoke cigars. They really like one another, no matter what they say. What we are trying to do, I assume, is to get back to the principles and aims and spirit of the Declaration of Independence. The spirit is resistance to illegitimate authority and to forces that deprive people of their life and liberty and right to pursue happiness. And therefore, under these conditions, it urges the right to alter or abolish their form of government. That's what the Declaration says. And the stress had been on abolish. But to establish the principles of the Declaration of Independence, we are going to need to go outside the law, to stop obeying the laws that demand killing, or that allocate wealth the way it has been done, or that put people in jail for petty technical offenses and keep other people out of jail for enormous crimes. My hope is that this kind of spirit will take place not just in this country, but in other countries, because they all need it. People in all countries need the spirit of disobedience to the state, which is not a metaphysical thing, but a thing of force and wealth. And we need a kind of declaration of interdependence among people in all countries of the world who are striving for the same thing.
The Japanese-American civil rights activist Yuri Kochiyama was born and raised in San Pedro, California. She and her family were among the 120,000 Japanese-Americans who were rounded up in a wave of anti-Japanese hysteria that followed the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Here she recalls her experiences in the camps.
I was red, white, and blue when I was growing up. I taught Sunday school and was very, very American. But I was also very provincial. We were just kids rooting for our high school. I was 19 at the time of the evacuation. I had just finished junior college. I was looking for a job and didn't realize how different the school world was from the work world. In the school world, I never felt racism. But when you got into the work world, it was very difficult. This was 1941, just before the war. I finally did get a job at a department store. But for us back then, it was a big thing, because I don't think they had ever hired an Asian in a department store before. I tried because I saw a Mexican friend who got a job there. Everything changed for me on the day Pearl Harbor was bombed. On that very day, December 7th, the FBI came and they took my father. He had just come home from the hospital the day before. For several days, we didn't know where they had taken him. Then we found out that he was taken to the federal prison at Terminal Island. Overnight, things changed for us. Most Japanese Americans had to give up their jobs, whatever they did, and they were told they had to leave. The edict for 9066, President Roosevelt's edict for evacuation, was in February 1942. We were moved to a detention center that April. We were sent to an assembly center in Arcadia, California in April. It was the largest assembly center on the West Coast, being nearly 20,000 5,000 people. There were some smaller centers with about 600 people. All along the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, there were many, many assembly centers, but ours was the largest. Most of the assembly centers were either fairgrounds or racetracks, so many of us lived in stables. And they said you could take what you could carry. I was so red, white, and blue. I couldn't believe this was happening to us. America would never do a thing like this to us. This is the greatest country in the world. So I thought, this is only going to be for a short while, maybe a few weeks or something, and they will let us go back. At the beginning, no one realized how long this would go on. I didn't feel the anger that much, because I thought maybe this was the way we could show our love for our country. And we should not make too much fuss or noise. We should abide by what they asked of us. I am a totally different person now. I was naive about so many things. The more I think, the more I realize how little you learn about American history. It's just what they want you to know. We always called the camps relocation centers while we were there. Now we feel it is apropos to call them concentration camps. It is not the same as the concentration camps of Europe. Those, we feel, were death camps. Concentration camps were a concentration of people placed in an area and disempowered and disenfranchised. So it is apropos to call what I was in a concentration camp. Historically, Americans have always been putting people behind walls. First, there were the American Indians who were put on reservations, Africans in slavery, their lives on the plantations, Chicanos doing migratory work in the kind of camps they lived in, and even to the Chinese when they worked on the railroad camps where they were almost isolated, dispossessed people, disempowered. And I feel those are the things we should fight against so they won't happen again. This whole period of what the Japanese went through is important. If we can see the connections of how often this happens in history, we can stem the tide of these things happening again by speaking out against them.
We end our readings with a speech by Cindy Sheehan, whose son Casey was killed in action in Iraq on April 4, 2004. This is from a speech she delivered in August at the Veterans for Peace Convention in Dallas, Texas, just before heading down to camp outside of Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas.
I said to my son not to go. You know it's wrong. You know you're going over there. You know your unit might have to kill innocent people. You know you might have to die. And he says, well, my buddies are going. If I don't go, my buddies will be in danger. 30 of our bravest young men have already died this month, and it's only the 5th of August. And the tragedy of the Marines in Ohio, it's awful. Do you think that George Bush is going to interrupt his vacation and go visit the families of the 20 Marines that have died in Ohio this week? No. No. Because he doesn't care. He doesn't have a heart. It's not enough to stop his little playing cowboy game in Crawford for 5 weeks. So, as you can imagine, every day the grieving parents that have lost, I don't like that word. It's the parents whose child was murdered. And it's extremely difficult. You can't even get a scab on our wound, because every day it's ripped open. So, anyway, when that filth spewer, that warmonger, George Bush, was speaking after the tragedy of the Marines in Ohio, he said a couple of things that outraged me, really outraged me. George Bush was talking, and he never mentioned the terrible incident of those Marines. But he did say that the families of the ones who've been killed can rest assured that their loved ones died for a noble cause. He also says, and he says this often, and it really drives me crazy, he said that we have to stay in Iraq and complete the mission to honor the sacrifices of the ones who have fallen. And I say, why should I want one more mother to go through what I've gone through because my son is dead? You know what? The only way that he can honor my son's sacrifice is to bring the rest of our troops home. To make my son's death count for peace and love and not war and hatred like he stands for. I don't want him using my son's death or my family's sacrifice to continue the killing. I don't want him to exploit the honor of my son and others to continue the killing. And I just had this brainstorm. I'm going to Crawford. I am. I don't know where Crawford is, but I'm going there. I don't care. I'm going, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to tell them, you get that evil maniac out here because a Gold Star mother, somebody whose son's blood is on his hands, has questions for him. And I'm going to say, okay, listen here, George. Number one, I demand every time you get up and spew the filth that you're continuing the killing in Iraq to honor my son's sacrifice, honoring the fallen heroes by continuing the mission, you say, except Casey Sheehan. You do not have my permission to use my son's name. And I'm going to say, and you tell me what the noble cause is that my son died for. And even if he starts to say freedom and democracy, I'm going to say, bullshit. You tell me the truth. You tell me that my son died for oil. You tell me that my son died to make your friends rich. You tell me that my son died so you can spread the cancer of Pax Americana imperialism in the Middle East. You get America out of Iraq. You get Israel out of Palestine, and you'll stop terrorism. And if you don't think that I won't say bullshit to the president, then you're wrong, because I'm going to say what's on my mind. So anyway, I'm going to go to Crawford tomorrow, and I'm going to say, get George out here. You get him out here. And if they say, no, he's not coming out, then I say, okay, I'm going to put up my tent here, and I'm going to stay until he comes and talks to me. And another thing I'm going to do. My son was killed in 2004, so I'm not paying my taxes for 2004. And I tell everybody that. And if I get a letter from the IRS, I'm going to say, you killed my son for this. I don't owe you anything. See, I live in Vacaville, California. If you can find me there, you come and get me. Come and get me and put me on trial. It's up to us as moral people to break immoral laws and resist. As soon as the leaders of a country lie to you, they have no authority over you at all. These maniacs have no authority over us, and they might as well be, and they might be able to put our bodies in prison, but they can't put our spirits in prison. When I was growing up, it was the communists. Now it's the terrorists. So you always have to have somebody that's our enemy to be afraid of, so the war machine can build more bombs and guns and bullets and everything. But I do see hope. I see hope in this country. 58% of the American public are with us. I mean, we're preaching to the choir, but everybody in the choir is not singing. If all of the 58% started singing, this war would end.
I want to thank all of you for coming. And I want to thank our readers, Ethel. Anthony Arnold, Jane Fonda, Marissa Tomei, Lucille Clifton, Ruben Martinez, Harry Washington, Scott Momaday. Thank you.
Listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.